Standing on the platform this morning,
Yeah.
waiting for my train. And I did something I basically never do. I actually looked down at the tracks. I
Yeah.
mean, really looked at them.
It's funny. It's not really something most people pay attention to. It's just, the rusty metal stuff that gets you to work.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
But then I just started thinking about the sheer violence involved.
Violence is a good word for it.
Because you have a train weighing, what, hundreds of tons?
Oh, easily. Thousands sometimes.
Thousands of tons. And it's just smashing down onto this relatively thin strip of metal, hour after hour, year after year. And it just feels like, well, it feels like it shouldn't work.
That is actually the perfect way to frame it. It is a completely chaotic, violent environment, and you're completely right. If you just look at the raw physics of it, it really shouldn't work as well as it does.
Right.
We kind of treat rails like they're just dumb infrastructure, like a paved road or a concrete sidewalk.
Yeah, just a hunk of iron.
But a modern steel rail is actually one of the most highly engineered materials on the entire planet.
And that is exactly what we are digging into today for this deep dive. Because I've got this massive stack of research here, including this huge review on steels for rails that just came out.
It's a dense one.
It really is. And my biggest takeaway from all these sources is that the ground beneath our feet is basically fighting this constant microscopic war against physics.
And it is a war being fought on a battlefield that is much, much smaller than people realize.
Yes. Okay, so this was the first stat that completely jumped out at me. Because we see a massive locomotive, right?
Right.
And we see a track stretching off into the horizon. But the actual connection point between the
That's
two,
tiny.
the source said the contact patch is roughly the size of a coin.
Yeah, I think it's a US quarter or a euro coin.
That's it.
That is the entire interface. So you have a freight train that might weigh 10,000 tons.
Unbelievable.
And all that weight is channeled down through the wheels, and it focuses onto a spot literally the size of your thumbnail.
The pressure in that spot must be just astronomical.
It is. We are talking about contact stresses that would completely crush most other materials.
So if you used, say, standard construction steel.
Like the I-beams in a
Yeah,
skyscraper.
exactly. If you made a rail out of that.
The wheel would just flatten it out. It would spread like dough under a rolling pin.
Wow. And yet the rail keeps its shape. It doesn't squish.
It does not squish.
And this is where I got really confused reading the research. Because I just assumed the reason it doesn't squish is because we're using some cutting-edge 21st century super material.
Right, like aerospace stuff.
Exactly. Like some titanium alloy or a carbon fiber composite, something invented in a lab 10 years ago.
You would definitely think so, especially given that we have high-speed trains doing 300 kilometers per hour now.
But we aren't using that.
No.
According to these notes, we are riding on chemistry that was invented in, wait, let me check, the 1850s.
1857, to be totally precise.
That is wild.
It is a Victorian-era technology. It's called perlitic steel. And honestly, this is the most fascinating part of the whole story for me.
How so?
Well, it is one of the very rare instances in the entire history of technology where the first real solution was so perfect, so incredibly elegant, that we haven't been able to beat it in 170 years.
We're just using the same stuff.
We are just tweaking the original recipe.
But it took them a while to actually find that recipe, right? Because the history section in this review reads like a compilation of absolute engineering
Oh,
disaster.
it was a mess. The early railways were an economic nightmare purely because the tracks just kept failing.
They started out with wood.
Back in the early mining days, yeah. But as you can imagine, wood just shreds under a heavy rolling load.
Would think so.
It creates massive splinters, it rots in the rain, it wears out in a matter of weeks. So around the mid-1700s, the engineer said, okay, let's use metal, let's try cast iron.
Which is super hard. I mean, my cast iron skillets last forever.
They are very hard,
Yeah.
but they are brittle. Cast iron is essentially like glass in this context. It has no give whatsoever.
So if the ground settles under it?
Which happens literally all the time with earthworks. If the ground settles unevenly, the rail wouldn't bend to match the new shape. It would just snap.
That is absolutely terrifying if you're a passenger on that train.
Exactly. So by the early 1800s, they swung all the way to the other extreme. They abandoned cast iron and used wrought iron.
Okay, and wrought iron is different how?
Wrought iron is ductile. It bends easily. It is tough.
Well, that sounds much safer.
It does, right. But I'm sure you can guess the problem. Bends easily is not really a great quality when you are trying to run a massive train in a perfectly straight line.
Right. It was too soft.
Way too soft. But worse than that, it was incredibly dirty.
Dirty? Yeah. Like covered in mud?
No, internal dirt. The manufacturing process back then left a lot of slag inside the iron.
Slag is just sort of waste rock.
Right. Basically mineral trash, just trapped right inside the metal. And the source material you have there describes exactly what happened to those wrought iron rails under pressure.
Yeah, this visual really stuck with me. It said the rails would shed silver-like slivers.
Just think about that for a second. The train runs over the track and the metal literally peels apart like string cheese. Here we're out there replacing rails every 3 to 6 months. The labor costs alone were eating the railway companies alive.
So they needed something right in the middle.
Exactly. They needed a material that was hard enough not to wear out, but tough enough not to snap like glass.
Enter our unsung hero, Robert Forrester Mushet.
The year is 1857, Derby in the UK. Mushet lays down the very first steel rail.
But he didn't just use random steel, right?
No, he figured out a highly specific alloy. He used a manganese pyrolytic structure.
And this was the killer app.
It completely changed the world. That single steel rail lasted for years in a spot where the iron ones were lasting months. It was a total paradigm shift.
So it replaced iron basically overnight.
Yes. And here is the real kicker. If you go out today and cut a slice out of a brand new modern rail manufactured in 2024 and put it under an electron microscope.
Yeah.
The fundamental architecture of that metal is absolutely identical to what Mushet made in 1857.
Okay, I have to stop you there. Let's unpack that. Because to me, as a modern consumer, that sounds like a massive failure of innovation.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, we have AI now. We have CRISPR gene editing. We have rockets that land themselves backward on ships. Why on earth haven't we come up with something better than Victorian steel for the ground we travel on?
It really comes down to two things, cost and physics. And mostly it comes down to this specific microscopic structure called perlite.
Ah, perlite. The notes describe this in a way that actually made me really hungry.
You mean the lasagna analogy?
Yes, lasagna analogy. It said that under a microscope, the steel literally looks like lasagna.
It is surprisingly accurate. If you zoom in on this real steel, it is not just a solid, homogeneous gray block. It's striped.
Like alternating layers.
Exactly. It's made of distinct alternating layers. You have a layer of ferrite and then a layer of cementite. Ferrite, cementite, ferrite, cementite.
Stacked up like sheets of pasta and cheese.
Stacked right up.
And these two ingredients, they do entirely opposite things, right?
Completely opposite. So ferrite is essentially just pure iron. It is soft. It can bend. It provides the toughness so the rail doesn't snap when the train hits it.
Okay, so that's the pasta. It's flexible. What about the cementite?
Cementite is iron carbide. It is incredibly hard, almost like a ceramic or even a diamond.
So you have a soft layer to absorb the shock, a hard layer to resist the wear.
Exactly. It is a natural composite material that forms all on its own as the metal cools. The hard cementite protects the soft ferrite from being ground away by the steel wheel. And the soft ferrite stops the hard cementite from shattering under the massive impact.
They just protect each other.
It's perfect synergy.
Okay, but if the recipe is exactly the same, how is a modern rail actually any better than the 1857 one? We must be doing something different in the factories today.
We are. We are shrinking the lasagna.
Shrinking.
We call it refining the interlamellar spacing.
Wow. Say that three times fast.
Right. It's just the fancy metallurgical term for the distance between the layers. The rule of thumb in rail metallurgy is actually incredibly simple.
What is it?
The tighter you pack those layers together, the harder the rail becomes.
So modern metallurgy is basically just figuring out how to squeeze these layers as thin and close as physically possible.
Essentially, yes. We use very precise cooling rates now. We blast the hot rail with air or water mist as it comes out of the furnace. This rapid cooling forces those alternating layers to form closer and closer together.
And why does closer mean harder?
It creates a barrier effect. If a microscopic crack tries to start in the soft iron layer, it hits a hard wall of cementite almost immediately and it stops.
Okay, but I have to push back on this a little bit because if we just need maximum hardness, why not just dump a bunch of other heavy metals in there?
Like what?
Like why not make a super alloy, throw in some titanium, some chromium? Why rely on this old layering trick with basic iron and carbon?
That is the $1 billion question. And the answer is very practical. Welding.
Welding.
Think about where these rails actually live.
Out in the elements.
Right. They span thousands of kilometers across deserts, mountains, freezing snow, and you have to join them together.
Right. You can't just lay down one continuous piece of steel from New York to Chicago.
Exactly. Yeah. If you make a super complex alloy with titanium or massive amounts of chromium, it becomes an absolute nightmare to weld.
Because it's too complicated.
Because it reacts terribly to the heat. You can't just fix it out in the field. Perlite gives you incredible strength with a very, very simple chemistry. It's mostly just iron and a little bit of carbon.
So it's basically weldable muscle.
That is a great way to put it, weldable muscle.
That makes total sense. Because if a track cracks in the middle of nowhere in Nebraska, you can't exactly send out a clean room and a team of rocket scientists to fix it.
You send a guy with a torch. But there is another big reason we stick with this specific structure, and it has to do with that dough problem we mentioned earlier.
The plastic flow.
Yes.
Right? The notes mentioned that the stress from the wheel doesn't just stay right on the surface.
No, it penetrates. When that tiny coin-sized contact patch hits the rail, the stress radiates deep down into the metal head.
All right.
If the steel underneath the surface is too soft, the metal inside the rail effectively turns into a liquid under that pressure. It flows.
That is such a disturbing image. Solid steel just flowing like a liquid.
We call it subsurface plastic flow. The top of the rail basically mushrooms out. It squashes and completely loses its shape. But the carbon in the perlite, those hard layers of cementite, they lock that internal structure in place.
So it physically prevents the rail from deforming from the inside out.
Exactly.
Okay, so we had this perfect perlitic structure. We've squeezed the layers super tight. We've stopped the plastic flow. But the rails still wear out eventually. Why?
Because in engineering, you can never have everything. Rail design is a massive game of trade-offs. You really have two main enemies out there, wear and fatigue.
Okay. Wear and fatigue.
And the really frustrating problem is that the solution for one is usually the cause of the other.
Walk me through that. Because wear is just the metal grinding away over time, right?
Correct. So to stop wear, you make the rail harder, you squeeze the perlite layers tighter.
Makes sense.
But when you make steel harder, you generally make it more brittle.
Ah. And that leads to the fatigue.
Rolling contact fatigue, to be specific. Or RCF. Think of it like a paperclip.
If you take a paperclip and bend it back and forth over and over.
Eventually it snaps. Exactly. A rail undergoes a stress cycle every single time a single wheel passes over it. Mm. Compress, release, compress, release.
Millions of times a year.
Millions. And this creates microscopic cracks right on the surface. If the rail is too hard, those tiny cracks travel incredibly fast. They shoot through the brittle metal, and they can cause a massive chunk of the rail head to just break right off.
So if you make it too soft, it grinds away. But if you make it too hard, it cracks.
You are constantly balancing on a knife edge.
That sounds incredibly stressful for the engineers.
Oh, it gets worse. Because then you have the issue of cleanliness.
Cleanliness, which, reading this, I assume, does not mean going out and washing the tracks with soap and water.
No, no. We are talking about metallurgical cleanliness.
Okay.
Impurities trapped deep inside the steel itself.
Kind of like the slag in the old iron rails from the 1800s.
It is a very similar concept, but on a totally microscopic scale. Modern steelmaking is absolutely obsessed with purity.
What kind of impurities are we looking for?
Tiny little bits of manganese sulfide or aluminum oxide. These are basically just leftovers from the chemical refining process.
But really, how much damage can a microscopic speck actually do to a massive steel rail?
It's the pee under the mattress effect, but deadly.
The pee under the mattress?
Yeah. Imagine you have this perfectly engineered lasagna structure. Strong, layered, incredibly tight. But suddenly, right in the middle of it, there is a hard microscopic rock of aluminum oxide trapped in the layers.
Right.
When the massive weight of the train hits that exact spot, the stress can't flow evenly through the metal. It hits that rock and it concentrates.
Oh, I see. It acts like a weak link.
We call it a stress riser. That single microscopic rock is where the fatigue crack starts. And once a crack starts, it spreads.
Wow.
That is exactly why modern railway specifications only allow parts per million of these impurities. Parts per million.
That is so strict. Now, the notes also mention hydrogen as a major villain, which sounded really weird to me because isn't hydrogen just a gas?
It is, and it is absolutely terrifying for steelmakers.
Terrifying? Why?
If even tiny amounts of atomic hydrogen get trapped in the molten steel at the factory, they get stuck in the metal lattice as it cools down and turns solid. And then later on, those atoms find each other and combine to form hydrogen gas molecules inside the solid metal.
What happens when gas forms inside solid steel?
It creates immense internal pressure. It causes what we call flaking or shatter cracks. The rail literally cracks from the inside out, and it can happen days or even weeks after the rail is manufactured.
It's basically a ticking time bomb.
Exactly.
So you are out there baking the most high-stakes cake in history.
Yeah.
One grain of sand, one little bubble of the wrong gas, and you could realistically cause a major derailment.
That is exactly right.
Right.
Which actually brings us to the manufacturing process itself, which is a whole drama on its own.
Yes.
Yeah.
I found this part of the reading surprisingly funny.
Funny?
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Because we all imagine rails as being these perfectly straight, incredibly rigid lines of metal.
Right.
But the actual process of making them straight involves bending them like a pretzel at the factory.
It is completely counterintuitive. So modern rails are made using continuous casting. You pour molten steel into a mold, and you pull out this never-ending strand of red-hot metal.
Right.
And then you use giant rollers to shape it into that familiar I-beam profile. But then the really hard part starts. It has to cool down.
And according to the review, the cooling is the problem because the shape isn't symmetrical.
Exactly. Look at the cross-section of a rail. You have the head at the top, which is big and thick.
Right.
Then you have the web in the middle, which is very thin, and the foot at the bottom, which is wide and flat.
So different thicknesses.
Yes. Because the web in the middle is thin, it loses heat and cools down very fast. But the head is thick, so it stays hot for much longer.
And since metal shrinks when it cools down.
The different parts of the single piece of metal are shrinking at totally different rates. So the rail curls.
It curls up.
If you look at a cooling bed in a steel mill, the rails look like giant bananas. They are significantly visibly curved.
So how on earth do you fix a 120-meter long steel banana?
Brute force. It's called roller straightening. They take this fully cooled, totally bent rail, and they force it through a series of massive offset rollers. These rollers violently bend the steel back and forth past its yield point until it finally surrenders and becomes straight.
That sounds incredibly traumatic for the metal.
Oh, it is. It totally solves the geometry problem.
Mm-hmm.
The rail comes out perfectly straight, but it creates an entirely new physics problem. It locks in residual stresses.
Residual stresses. What does that actually mean in practice?
It means the rail is secretly fighting itself. Even though it is sitting there looking perfectly still on the ground, the molecules inside are constantly pulling and pushing against each other, using enormous force just to hold that straight line.
Does that internal tension make it weaker?
See, there is a massive debate about this exact question in the engineering community right now.
Really?
Yes. Basic logic says yes, internal tension is a bad thing. It should make the rail more prone to snapping. But there is a really fascinating insight in the research you flagged.
I remember this. Some experts basically argue that the residual stress doesn't matter at all.
Right.
But why wouldn't it? If the metal is under tension, it seems like a disaster waiting to happen.
Because of the train. The theory is that the very first time a fully loaded, massive freight train rolls over that brand new piece of rail, the weight is so immense that it actually squashes the metal just enough to organically redistribute all those built-up stresses.
Wait, are you saying the train essentially finishes the manufacturing process?
In a way, yes. The initial service load breaks in the rail, and it neutralizes the tension left over from the factory straightening process.
That is wild.
It's practical engineering at its best.
Okay, so let's assume we have made this perfect, pure, ultra-clean, perfectly straight rail. And it's 120 meters long.
A beautiful piece of steel.
But the train track from New York to Chicago is obviously a lot longer than 120 meters. You have to join them together.
And here is the Achilles heel of the entire railway system. The joint is always, without fail, the weakest link.
Now, in the old days, the joints were what made that classic clickety-clack sound, right? Because they left physical gaps between the rails.
Yes. Those were bolted joints. They left gaps so the metal could expand in the summer heat without buckling the track.
Right.
But those joints are absolute maintenance nightmares. The bolts constantly loosen. The rail ends get battered down by the wheels every time they jump the gap.
So we don't use those anymore?
Mostly no. Modern railways want continuous welded rail. Basically, one smooth, unending ribbon of steel. No gaps, no clickety-clack.
But wait a minute. You just spent 10 minutes telling me that Heat ruins the incredibly precise lasagna structure of the perlite.
I did.
And welding is entirely about applying massive amounts of heat.
And that is the absolute tragedy of the joint. To join these rails, we have no choice but to melt them. And when you melt perlitic steel, you destroy that carefully engineered, tightly packed, layered structure.
They're just totally recooking the pasta.
And you are overcooking it terribly. In the heat-affected zone, right next to the actual weld, the heat radically changes the microstructure. You get what we call a softened zone.
So the layers vanish.
The layers literally break down. The cementite turns into little disconnected globs instead of sheets. We call it spheroidized cementite.
Globs definitely don't sound as strong as structural layers.
They aren't. Not even close. So you end up with a track that is perfectly hard and strong for 120 meters, and then suddenly you hit a soft spot, then hard again for 120 meters, then another soft spot.
And I'm guessing those heavy train wheels severely punish those soft spots.
They absolutely do. The metal wears out much faster right there. You get dips in the track, or something called corrugation, which are these wavy, rhythmic bumps.
Is that why sometimes you're on a train and it suddenly starts vibrating or getting really loud periodically?
Yes. If it's a rhythmic vibration, you are probably rolling over a series of softened welds.
Fascinating. Now, the notes talked about two main ways they actually do this welding out in the real world. One is high-tech, and one is, well, it borders on pyromania.
You mean the thermite weld?
The thermite weld. I have actually seen videos of this online. It looks like a literal bomb going off of the tracks.
It is basically a controlled volcano.
Why do they do it like that?
Well, think about the logistics. If a rail snaps in the middle of a forest in Canada, you can't bring a massive factory welding machine out there to fix it.
Right.
So track crews hike in with a crucible, a bucket.
A bucket of what?
They fill it with aluminum powder and iron oxide, and then they light a fuse.
And it burns at, wait, what did the notes say? 2,500 degrees Celsius.
Yes, it burns so incredibly hot that it turns that powder into liquid molten iron almost instantly. Then they tap the bottom of the bucket, and this superheated liquid metal just flows straight down into a mold clamped around the two broken rail ends.
And it just melts everything together.
Fuses the gap completely.
Honestly, it sounds incredibly effective.
It is great for portability. You can do it anywhere. But metallurgy-wise.
Not so good.
It's really sloppy. Remember, it's a casting. It's just liquid poured into a mold. It hasn't been precisely cooled. It hasn't been rolled or squashed or treated like the factory rail.
So the structure is a mess.
The grain structure is very coarse. It is significantly weaker than the rail itself, but it is just the necessary evil of keeping the trains moving when you're out in the field.
Now, the source did mention a potential third way to join rails, something that sounds straight out of sci-fi. Friction welding.
Ah, friction welding. This is the ultimate dream for rail engineers.
Because there's no electricity arcs and no chemical bombs.
Exactly. You literally just take the two solid rail ends and you rub them together.
Like rubbing two sticks together to start a campfire.
Exactly like that. You vibrate them against each other, or you use a rotating intermediate piece of metal, and you move it so fast that the sheer physical friction generates the heat.
And why is that better than melting it with thermite?
Because it happens at a lower temperature than the actual melting point of the steel. You don't turn it into a liquid. And because you don't melt it, you don't completely destroy the microstructure. You don't get that massive softened zone.
So it's so much better. Why aren't we just doing this everywhere right now? Let's do it.
Because steel is extraordinarily hard.
Oh, wait.
Friction welding works beautifully for softer metals, like aluminum. Apple uses friction welding for the stands on their iMacs. The aerospace industry uses it to join airplane fuselages.
But rail steel is different.
Rail steel is so hard that to physically stir two pieces of it together, you need a machine tool that is significantly harder than the rail itself.
And I'm guessing a tool that hard is incredibly expensive.
Rail steel eats those expensive tools alive. It wears them out so incredibly fast that it is just not economically viable on a large scale yet.
Wow.
So for now, we are stuck with the big factory welders and the field thermite bombs.
It is just amazing to think about all of this. I mean, I rely on this transit system every single day. I sit in my seat, I read a book, I drink my coffee. I have never once thought about the microscopic structure of the metal spinning under the wheels.
It really is a triumph of engineering balance. That is the big takeaway for me from all this research.
A balance of what?
Of everything. You are carefully balancing hardness to prevent wear with toughness to prevent snapping. You are balancing the need for perfectly straight tracks with the brutal physics of cooling metal.
Right.
And maybe, most impressively, you are balancing 19th century Victorian chemistry with 21st century parts per million purity standards.
And you are doing all of that on a tiny little contact patch, the exact size of a coin.
Exactly. The next time you hear a train go by, don't just look at the massive cars. Try to visualize that tiny little contact patch.
The lasagna.
Yes. Visualize those microscopic layers of ferrite and cementite, the lasagna being squeezed by thousands of tons of pressure, essentially holding up the entire global economy.
It is an incredible image. But here is the final thought I want to leave on, because something the review pointed out really stuck with me. We are constantly pushing the limits of this system.
Always.
The commuter trains are getting faster and faster. The freight cars are getting massively heavier. The notes mention we are seeing 40-ton axle loads now and heavy mining operations in places like Australia and Brazil.
That is the big looming question in the industry right now.
Because we have fully optimized this perlite structure, we have squeezed the layers about as tightly as physical laws allow. We have cleaned out the impurities down to literally parts per million.
We have perfected it.
But have we hit the wall?
It is a very valid fear.
Yeah.
Steel has served us incredibly well for 170 years. But are we finally approaching the absolute fundamental limit of what iron and carbon can actually do under pressure?
Right. If we want to go even faster in the future or carry even heavier loads, do we need to invent a totally new supermaterial entirely?
Or do we just accept that we are riding a Victorian technology straight to its absolute breaking point?
The rails of the future might need to be made of something that Robert Muschiet wouldn't even recognize. But for now, that rhythmic clickety-clack is just the sound of chemistry holding the modern world together.
Absolutely.
Well, that is certainly something for you to chew on during your next commute. Thanks for joining us for another deep dive.
Safe travels out there.